Thanks, Kathy. Actually, it's my privilege anytime I can be at something that Kathy is sponsoring or doing, because would that I had that kind of energy. A year ago, it's pretty much for most people when they finally heard the word ISIS and it frightened them. A group that had been called the JV team suddenly seemed to be winning the Super Bowl in the Middle East. You know, what in the world is happening? What's going on? A little before that, a friend and I decided it was going to become a major event. We needed to help people understand it, so that's when we put this book together. So it was about a year ago. It was a year ago. I was writing the last part of this book, getting ready to publish. What I want to share with you is kind of a synopsis of what's in the book, but I want to do it in a way that helps you at least understand what's going on. What is it that we need to know about ISIS? That's going to be the most crucial thing. And I got to point this in just the right spot, and I'm going to try and break it down in a very simple way. Really, there are four key facts you need to know if you want to understand ISIS. And fact number one is Islam is at the center of the problem. I tell my classes when I teach sometimes, you need to take what I'm going to say with a grain of salt. There's a few times when you need the whole salt shaker. It's a high salt presentation. This might be one of those times, because I'm going to touch on things that for some they say that sounds politically incorrect. This happens to be one of them. Islam really is at the center of the problem. It's the center of understanding ISIS. You need to understand Islam. The first part of it is the Sunni-Shia split. And you go, what's that? Muhammad died, and shortly after Muhammad's death, the real question was, who's going to replace Muhammad? One group said, it's the tradition within the group. It's the, you know, let's get the group's consensus. And the Sunnis, the Sunna developed, looking at the tradition. What's the consensus of the group? Another group said, no, we're the partisans of Ali. Muhammad's successor has to be from his family line. It has to be a blood relation, much like kings are following blood relation. This group called themselves the partisans of Ali, Shiatu Ali, but it became ultimately what we would know as the Shia. And the Sunni-Shia split took place within Islam very soon after the death of Muhammad. To put that into a perspective, here's a map of the Middle East. Here's how those groups divide. Let's see. There we go. The light green is the Sunni. The majority, and it's hard to give the estimates, but you'll hear 80 to 85% of Muslims are Sunni. Now that can skew just a bit, because most people in Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country, are Sunni. In India, they're Sunni. So within the Middle East, it's probably about 75% are Sunni. The Shiites, if you notice where it is, it's predominantly Iran. It's the southern part of Iraq. It's the western part of Syria and part of Lebanon. Oh, and if the map extended down, you'd find it at the very southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, down near Yemen. Isn't it interesting that most of the conflicts taking place today in the Middle East are Iraq and Syria, at the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula near Yemen? Because there's a conflict between the Sunnis and the Shiites that's still going on. Muslim hatred towards Jews and Christians. If you follow the Middle East, you know, here's what's commonly said. The hatred toward the Christians is because of the Crusades. The Christians started the Crusades, and that's why the Muslims don't trust them. The hatred toward the Jews is predominantly because of the state of Israel, or what's said more specifically, it's because Israel occupies the West Bank. There are Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and if we could just get rid of the settlements, it would solve the problem. That's not true. And here's some examples. The Hadith, by the way, hold on, so this is this works. Okay, the Hadith are the sayings of Muhammad. You've heard of the Quran. The Quran is the Muslim Bible. Those are the words that Muhammad supposedly got directly from God. They're the ones that Muslims believe word for word. The Hadith are sayings of Muslim. That is, one person said, oh, you know, I heard Muhammad say this, and it was one of his early followers. Those sayings were collected. There are different levels of trust in those sayings, but a number of the Hadith are accepted as the true statements of Muhammad. And so this is the one you'll often hear. The last hour will not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews, and the Muslims would kill them, until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree. And the stone or tree would say, Muslim, or servant of Allah, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him. That's nothing to do with the nation of Israel. Nothing to do with West Bank settlements. That's a statement that is supposedly attributed to Muhammad by his early followers and accepted as authoritative within Islam. Is it still up here? Hold on. I know it's going to work. We just have to have it pointed to exactly the right spot. Yes. There we go. The Quran itself says, fight those who believe not in Allah or the last day, or hold that which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they're people of the book. By the way, Jews and Christians are considered in the Quran people of the book. You follow the original revelation of God. But the Muslims are told to fight against them until they pay the jizya, the money paid by non-Muslims, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Muslims are to fight against Jews and Christians. And the only one, only time it's to stop is when they finally say, okay, wait, you're in charge, you're right, we will pay the due to acknowledge that you are in charge. That's the statement from the Quran. The Quran also says, those who disbelieve from among the people of the book and among the polytheists will be in hellfire to dwell therein forever. They're the worst of creatures. So even if you're paying the jizya, the tax, if you refuse to acknowledge that Muhammad is the prophet of Allah, that the Quran is the word of God, you're going to hell. And you're the worst of creatures, which is why they don't necessarily have to respect you, even if you are willing to accept their control, which is why the Christians and the Jews in the Middle East are suffering so much right now by the hands of ISIS. You say, well, that's back then. This can't be fairly recent. Haj Amin al-Husseini was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem right at the beginning of World War II. In fact, he ended up going to Berlin and became the spokesman for Hitler to the Muslims. And he wrote, Arise, O sons of Arabia, fight for your sacred rights. Slaughter Jews wherever you find them. Their spilled blood pleases Allah, our history, and religion. That will save our honor. That sounds like it could have been said by an ISIS fighter today. But it wasn't. It was before the formation even of the State of Israel. So what we're seeing is nothing new. In fact, one of the problems that people are having today is trying to reconcile what Islam teaches with our understanding that it's supposedly a religion of peace. If you know Ayan Hirsi Ali, she is a Muslim who became an atheist, who's written several prominent books. They're worth reading to describe her experience. She wrote, Islam is being taken to its natural conclusion by Hamas, by Boko Haram, and by ISIS. They're not the exception to Islam. They are more closely aligned with what Muhammad taught and practiced than anyone else. She's also said, the call to violence and the justification for it are explicitly stated in the sacred texts of Islam. And they are. Now, a Muslim can say, I choose not to believe the Quran. However, that wouldn't be a healthy thing to say if you were living somewhere like Saudi Arabia or in a Muslim country. But the texts of Islam do speak of violence, not only against disbelievers, but against the people of the book, the Christians and the Jews. That's fact number one. Fact number two, we want to move from ancient history to more modern. The current Middle East crisis, how did the Middle East get to be such a mess? And my suggestion to you is that it all started in World War I. Now, for typical Americans today, we are not lovers of history or geography. Those are two subjects Americans do the worst at. We tend to be forward-thinking, look to the future. But as a result, we're very bad at the past. Vietnam War is ancient history for probably half of America today. World War II, they know something about. World War I, they know virtually nothing about. And yet World War I is crucial to understanding the Middle East and the problems that we have today there. Yeah, I'll get the right spot here. There we go. In World War I, you had the Allied powers, France, Britain, the United States eventually came in, fighting against the other powers, which were primarily Germany, the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. Russia was on the side of the Allies, but they dropped out when communism took over in Russia. So you had this major battle going on. The French and the British decided to make a series of secret agreements, or not so secret in some cases, but they made a promise to the Arabs.
How many of you remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia with Peter O'Toole running across the desert? I'll get this spot here one of these days. Hold on, we know it's there. Find the spot. Find the spot. Okay. I can do this as long as you want. Flicker. Let's see if I hit right there. Will that do it? No. There. We knew it was going to be there. It has this narrow little window I've got to try and hit. Here's what the British wrote to the Arabs. This, by the way, is Lawrence of Arabia. That was a little bit dramatic, but essentially true story with the movie. The British wrote, "I am empowered in the name of the government of Great Britain to give the following assurance and make the following reply to your letter. Subject to the above modifications, Great Britain is prepared to recognize and support the independence of the Arabs within the territories and the limits and boundaries proposed by the Sharif of Mecca." So they wrote to the ruler of Mecca and said, "Hey, if you'll assist us, if you'll rebel against the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, we will give you an Arab country of your own." And in fact, as it's been described, as you described to us, that's what we understand. Well, the Arabs understood it in one way. The British may have had a slightly different opinion, but they promised the Arabs, "Join us in the rebellion, you'll have your own country." That was the first agreement. Let me see if I can hit this a little closer. They also made a promise to the Jews. And if you know the Balfour Declaration, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this objective. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by the Jews in any other country." By the way, that last little bit, if you're watching television today, that's the stuff that appears in like one point type really quick along the bottom of the screen, and you're not to realize, read it real fast as it goes along. It basically negates what they said in the first part, but they were emphasizing the first part. "We're going to promise the Jewish people a homeland. You're living there. It's been your traditional homeland. You've been saying next year in Jerusalem all these years. When we're done defeating the Ottomans, as we carve up their empire, we're making a homeland for the Jewish people." Now, can you imagine the problem we'd have if you showed up? I sold you a house, and you finally came the day to take possession of the house. You showed up, and there's another couple there ready to take possession of the same house because I sold it to them as well. We have a problem. The British and the French were making all sorts of promises, and they promised, in essence, what people thought was the same land to two different groups of people. No wonder there's a problem in the Middle East. It gets worse. We're going to get real close to it here. Let's see. They had a secret agreement between the French and the British. They weren't going to really keep either of those promises. It's called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And that's one tiny little narrow spot up there. Hold on. Here's what it was going to look like. The French and the English said, "Well, tell you what, let's just draw some lines through the Middle East. This is so small, but you can see the big letters A and B and the blue and the orange areas. That's all that's important." They said, "Okay, we'll draw that line A and B. A is going to be an area, we're going to say we're giving it to the Arabs, but really the French are going to control it. You'll notice it happens to be most of Syria and part of Iraq. B is the area we're going to say we're going to give to the Arabs, but the British will really kind of run it. It has a lot of Iraq and most of Jordan in it. And then there's going to be one area, the all blue, the French say, we're not even going to give that to the Arab, we're keeping it. We're going to control it. It's a lot of what's Turkey today. The British said, we're going to do the same thing, and it's going to be the southern part of Iraq. Now, why would the British want the southern part of Iraq? Yeah. Out of the ground comes a bubbling crude, oil that is, black gold. They had just converted their entire fleet. The British were known for the fleet. The British Empire ruled the world through its fleet. It had converted from coal to oil. They needed a supply of petroleum. They said, we're going to keep that. That's for us. And by the way, if you notice where the parties they were going to promise to the Jews, they said, well, let's just say that's going to be under international control, meaning us. We'll control that together. They had no intention of fulfilling what they had really promised to both of those other groups. So you end up with the Middle East. And did you ever wonder why, let's say the border between Syria, Jordan, and Iraq is a nice straight line?
That's because the map was drawn by the British and the French on a map with a ruler without any regard to ethnic or geographical boundaries. They created the problems in the modern Middle East that we have today. They carved out a country named Iraq. I always thought there was an Iraq, always. And I found out that there wasn't. Iraq, actually, under the Ottomans, was three separate divisions. Part of it in the north was run by the Kurds, centered in Mosul. In the center was the Sunni Arab area, centered in Baghdad. In the south were the Shiites, centered in Basra. The British create, and French create, this one so-called country, carved together, cobbled together with three groups that don't get along. And you wonder why there are problems in the Middle East. I got to keep pointing over this way. I love Field Marshal Archibald Wavell. He said, after the war to end war, remember, World War I is the war to end all war. After the war to end war, they seem to have been pretty successful in Paris at making a peace to end peace. And he's right. That's why the problems since World War I have extended. They carved an empire up that had natural animosity and enmity built into it. If I'm getting it right about there. We're going to get that spot. Oh, and I went too far. Hold on. See, that's the problem. You go too fast and then it finally connects and you're in trouble. There we go. Fact number three. Water is as precious as oil. When we think of the Middle East, we think of a place awash in oil, lots of stuff, lots of resources. In reality, the Middle East does have oil, but most countries are oil poor. But one thing that they all share in common is that they're water poor. They're desperate for water, and some of the decisions that have been made in the last 20 years have made it even worse. Now I've got to get that other slide up here. Come on here. There it is. This, again, horrible map. I didn't design it, but I found it. But you see a lot of little green dots. Those are the keys. You're looking at Turkey. You're looking at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And you happen to be seeing all the dams that Turkey has built over the Tigris and Euphrates River. Turkey decided they needed water. They needed hydroelectric power. They needed water. And so they built 22 dams, 19 hydroelectric plants on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in Turkey. That reduced the water flow into Syria by 40%. It reduced the water flow into Iraq by 80%. Cut off water and you're creating problems. And let's see here. There it is. Sadly, this is going to be three pictures. The first one, I don't see a whole lot. This is the Ataturk Dam in Turkey. That's the picture number one. Get up there. See? Get the right spot. If I find the spot, I'm going to hit all three of these so we'll get them all up together. Oh, yeah, wouldn't you know I'm going to do that? Okay, one. Oh, it's going to skip them. Okay. What it ended up showing is that dam grew. There's this green area within Turkey that's growing. They're irrigating Turkey. It's growing lusher. Meanwhile, this is what it looks like in Iraq and Syria. The water is disappearing on them. Look here one more time. Imagine you're earning your living as a fisherman, and there's no water anymore. What happens when you don't have water? Well, it's just horrid sanitary conditions. You're living with whatever you can find. Of course, people are going to leave that area. You can no longer afford to live there. You're going to crowd into the cities. So now I have the Sunnis and the Shiites. I have the Kurds, the Yazidis. I have all these different ethnic groups, different religious groups coming together in cities with no employment, no housing, none of the other basic essentials. And I've got a perfect environment for war. All I need to do is light the match. And the match was lit. We ended up with the problems we have in the Middle East. And you say, but wait, it gets worse. There's less water, but there's more problems. From 1980 to 2013, I picked that deliberately because that's about the time the civil war really started impacting Syria. From 80 to 2013, Syria's population grew from 9 million to 23 million. Their water supply went down by 40%. Their population went up by 150%. In Iraq, same period of time, the population grew from 13.7 million to 33.3 million. Again, almost 150%. Their water supply went down by 80%, or 60%. So you have this incredible drop in water supply. You have an incredible rise in population. No wonder they have all of the ethnic tensions that were there prior to the Arab Spring. The Middle East experienced a prolonged drought. The past decade has been the driest in a century in the Middle East. So you don't have the water from the Tigris-Euphrates, you don't have the natural rainfall that comes along, and you have a huge population increase. You've got problems in the Middle East. Yes, thank you. Oh, this is going to be perfect now. Well, man. Fact number four, the Middle East is a complex ethnic and religious tapestry. Not only do we have all these other problems, the fourth fact, though, is that it's so complex ethnically. And the next slide, then. Ethnically, you have Arabs, Jews, Kurds, Persians, Turks, Copts, Armenians, Assyrians, Chaldeans, and Azeris. We always think of the Middle East as a bunch of Arabs. It's not. By the way, Iran would actually pride themselves on not being Arab. They are Persian. One of the key differences between the Iranians and the Iraqis historically. Religiously, you have the Sunnis, who are the majority, the Shiites, but there's also Jews, Christians, and Christians, by the way, of all sects. Druze, Yazidis, Baha'is, Alawites, and the current national boundaries don't correspond to those major ethnic and religious divisions. So the World War I ended up carving up a place that has no corresponding national or religious background. Incredibly complex. The water problem forced these different groups together. It was just ripe for having a major problem. Okay. So what should it look like? It should look like something. This. If you divided it just based on the ethnic groups, you have a Shiite state in the southern part of Iraq. That's the Arab Shiite. Northern part of Iraq and the northeastern part of Syria would be a Sunni state. That's where the majority Sunni Arabs are. In the far northern part of Iraq, you would have a Kurdish area. In fact, it would be much larger than this map shows. The Kurds are a group that extend into Turkey, they extend into Iran, they extend into Syria and Iraq. They're the largest ethnic group in the world without their own country. And then in the far western side, you would have the Alawites, which are an offshoot of the Shiites. By the way, the head of Syria today is from the Alawite sect. It's a minority ruling over a majority. And you look at that and say, well, how did that come about? Well, isn't it interesting that ISIS is growing right where the Sunni state is in northern Iraq and eastern Syria? They're taking advantage of the ethnic boundaries that are there, and that's why they've been so successful. Okay, so then we can ask the question, okay, but where did ISIS come from and how did it get so powerful? If that's the history, that's the background, you can see why there's a potential for tension. But where did ISIS itself come from? And you know the book by Darwin, The Origin of the Species. I don't have it up here to talk about Darwin, but I love the picture, you know, on the front. So the next picture will kind of give you my take on it. Here's the origin of ISIS. You can see the people rolling, you know, coming from the apes up, but finally end up with the guy with the black flag. Where in the world did this group come from? I want to take you to 1979. Now, the pictures are all up here. So let me walk you around these pictures. I'm going to start in the lower right. 1979. No, I'm sorry. Keep that one up there. Lower right-hand picture. If you see that, it's Three Mile Island. Anybody remember Three Mile Island? I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, up the Susquehanna River from Three Mile Island. Remember it well. That was 1979. Just above it, CIA Pentagon, Uncle Sam, Vietnam wounded you, Iran will bury you. You may remember that was the Iran hostage crisis, which was 1979 it began. What started the Iran hostage crisis? Upper left-hand corner is one of our dear buddies, Ayatollah Khomeini. Came to power in 1979, threw over the Shah of Iran, and created the first Islamic republic, if you will. So it's actually the first Islamic fundamentalist state was started by Khomeini. And then, you remember those well. You may not remember so well the picture right in the middle. 1979, Russia invaded Afghanistan. The end of the year. It was kind of a surprise. End of an otherwise rather bad year internationally. It sounds much like today, doesn't it? With all the turmoil going on. 1979 is where I trace the origins of ISIS to. But I've got to track them along. And so it looks like this. How do you connect the dots from 1979 to where we are today? Because at first they look like they're going all over the place. But let me try and simplify without becoming too simplistic. Trace the dots down from that event that year to ISIS. The first dot that I want to put in is Afghanistan. Russia invaded Afghanistan. And in response to Russia's invasion, a group was came up. We called them in our press at the time the Afghan Freedom Fighters, the Mujahideen. Did anybody ever notice what the middle part of that word comes from? Jihad. They were Islamic, Sunni Islamic fundamentalist fighters who rose up to get rid of the godless Russians who had invaded their land. And we supported them. In fact, the next slide. Russian base in Afghanistan, 1979. And then the next one after that, here come the Afghan freedom fighters, the Taliban. Oh, sorry, the Afghan Mujahideen. I got to get the right word here. Mujahideen, the Afghan freedom fighters. Next slide. Did any of you see the picture? Charlie Wilson's war? That's the actual Charlie Wilson, congressman from Lufkin, Texas, who got the CIA to pour billions of dollars into Afghanistan, giving the U.S. some of the most sophisticated weapons America had to Islamic fundamentalist terrorists to use against the Russians. Unfortunately, they weren't all used against the Russians. But that was the step number one. This group came along. 1979, in Iran you had Shiite terrorists, state-sponsored. In Afghanistan you have Sunni terrorists rising up, these Mujahideen. In fact, 1988, they were so effective, Russia finally had to leave Afghanistan. They pulled out. That helped contribute to the fall of the Soviet Union. There were other factors as well, but their debacle in Afghanistan helped. By the way, why did Charlie Wilson do what he did? The Russians had helped the Viet Cong to bleed America dry in Vietnam. He was wanting to have payback. We're going to help, due to the Russians, what they had done to us. But that was the Afghan freedom fighters, so-called, the Mujahideen. Leads to the next of the dots. Dot number two. Now I'm in Afghanistan, but we're going to the Taliban, who are still around, by the way, and causing just as much problem today, it seems, as ever. We thought we got rid of them. We haven't. Afghanistan. Russia pulls out, and we could care less. America loses interest in Afghanistan. Our only goal there had been to cause problems for the Russians. So we pull out and we leave a country that's an absolute basket case. It was ruled by different Islamic warlords. And finally one group rose up, these Taliban. This is their group photo, if you will. This group rose up. They were called Taliban, which comes from a word for student. They were students, but they weren't students like university students. They were students of Islam. They had been trained in not just how to fight, but what the Quran taught and how to set up a Quranic capital that would follow Sharia law. And this group managed to suppress the other groups and establish order in Afghanistan. But they established order at a price. And Afghanistan became known as the land of the blue burqas. Women were pulled out of schools. If you remember the statue of Buddha that was there, that was blown up because they were getting rid of all idolatry, even though it was considered a natural cultural heritage. They were going to turn Afghanistan into what the Quran says a Muslim place ought to look like. That was the role of the Taliban in in Afghanistan. Which leads to a third dot, Al-Qaeda. You may not realize it, but within Islam, you pledge loyalty to a group or pledge loyalty to a follower, and it's taken very seriously. If you break that pledge of loyalty, you could be in trouble. Osama bin Laden pledged his loyalty to the Taliban. The Muhammad Omar was the head of it all, and Osama bin Laden pledged his loyalty to Muhammad Omar. So Al-Qaeda came out of the Taliban. For the next picture, get the dating here for you. 79, Russia invades Afghanistan. 88, Russia leaves Afghanistan. I want to jump to 1990, 2 years after Russia left Afghanistan. Now, it's going to sound like I'm going to move to a whole different area for a second, so bear with me. That's Afghanistan. We now look over here. I'm going to go over to Iraq. Saddam Hussein's in Iraq, secular Iraqi government. He invades Kuwait, August of 1990. He's threatening Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia falls, we're in deep trouble here in the United States because we're still very dependent on Middle East oil coming from Saudi Arabia. So what does the United States do in 1990? We rush forces into Saudi Arabia to first keep the Iraqis out, and then later, first Gulf War, to force Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. We would look at it, we pictured our friends, we were there to save Saudi Arabia. How did Al-Qaeda, how did Osama bin Laden view what was happening? man, we just got rid of the one godless nation, anti-Islamic nation. We kicked them out of Afghanistan. And an even worse nation has just showed up, and not just showed up anywhere, it showed up where the two holiest sites are in all Islam. Here's America, and they've come into Saudi Arabia. We have got to do something about it. And that was Osama bin Laden's cry. By the way, Al-Qaeda, kind of an interesting name. You ever know where that name came from? In Arabic, it means the base. Like, I'm going to go out to the base, Luke Air Force Base. It means the base. It's named after the base that he had helped start in the Afghan, Pakistan area, where he had helped bring in fighters for the war against Russia. He named his group after the base they'd started. He called it the base. Al-Qaeda had begun during the Afghanistan war with loyalty to the Taliban. But now Osama bin Laden's going to be on a crusade. He's got to stop these Americans who have now invaded his perspective, invaded Saudi Arabia. So how is he going to do it? You might not remember this. The first Al-Qaeda operation ever undertaken was in Aden, Yemen. Wow, Yemen in the news again. How about that? Yemen, he decided to bomb two hotels. We were sending, as we sent our Marines into that region, we were sending them through Aden. And unfortunately, his intelligence wasn't quite on target. Our soldiers weren't there when the hotels were bombed. He had the right idea, he thought, but he just had bad timing. So it just escaped our notice. That was 1992. Next event that he had, 1998, he got a little better. He decided to bomb two embassies, Tanzania and Kenya. You might remember that caused quite a bit of damage. There were Americans who were killed there. A lot more locals were killed. And major thing. The State Department wasn't sure who did it. They finally figured out it was some unknown group named Al-Qaeda. But that escaped most of our notice. That was followed. 2000, they decided to have another attack. They had this great idea. We're going to load a little rubber raft. We're going to put all these explosives on it. We're going to run it into an American ship, the USS the Sullivans, down in Yemen. We're going to run it against the ship, and we're going to blow it up. Unfortunately, they put too many explosives on the rubber raft, and it sank. And we didn't pay attention, because later that year, they said, let's put a few less explosives on the raft and take it in the same area, same spot. This time it was the USS Cole. It did work. They killed our soldiers. That was Al-Qaeda. They were still becoming more sophisticated, trying to extend their reach. That was about that time. We were forcing them out of the African area, but they said we've got a better plan altogether. 2001. Let's take some airplanes and run them into the World Trade Center. That's when most of the world suddenly woke up and said, there's an Al-Qaeda out there. They had been around for a decade. We just hadn't paid attention. Until suddenly we wake up and we're shocked. You remember the scenes. I mean, that's 14 years ago. And I can still remember exactly where I was the day that happened. I know what I was doing, and I know how everything stopped. I was in a board meeting at Moody Bible Institute, and the board meeting got started and never finished. We just brought in a television, spent the rest of the day watching those events. That's when we suddenly started paying attention. But up till then, it had just passed under our radar. The next stop becomes Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I'm listed separately because something happened within Al-Qaeda. We finally did wake up, and we decided we were going to hunt down Osama bin Laden. End of 2001, and it extended, by the way, all the way to 2011 when we finally got him. It was over a 10-year hunt for Osama bin Laden. But here's what happened. October 2001, right after the World Trade Center bombing, U.S. forces invaded Afghanistan. We drove the Taliban from power. December 2001, we actually knew where bin Laden was. It was the first time, and then almost the last until 2011, when we knew where he was. He escaped from Tora Bora and went into hiding in Pakistan. From early 2002, Al-Qaeda's leadership was in hiding. The head of it all, bin Laden, his second-in-command, they had to go into hiding. All of their directions had to come remotely, and they decided we need to change. We need to somehow operate this thing in a different way or it's not going to work. So they changed the way they operated, and the word that's been used, it's kind of a bad analogy, but it's the only analogy that was given. They adopted what we would often call a franchise model, We still know what we want to do, but we're going to franchise out Al-Qaeda and have each of these countries adopt their own operations, but they're going to be following the general directions from on high. And so because of bin Laden hiding, because of his second-in-command hiding, they went to this more of a franchise model. Well, 2011, we thought Al-Qaeda was done for. We got bin Laden. It must all be over. You know, the war on terrorism. Isn't interesting, by the way, it doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, both of them have made the mistake of claiming that we've gotten, we've gotten them down, we've degraded them, mission accomplished, all those words that came back to haunt us. But we thought that was the end. All those papers announcing bin Laden dead. When bin Laden was in hiding and after he died, his second-in-command took over. How many of you know Ayman al-Zawahiri? Less well-known, right? This guy is an Egyptian medical doctor. Took over Al-Qaeda. He has none of the charisma of Osama bin Laden. He just wasn't that strong a leader. But he's still in charge, by the way, of Al-Qaeda. But that's the guy. He gives these franchises. Well, within the franchises, there was a franchise called Al-Qaeda in Iraq that went through a number of people, but they managed to get one fellow in charge who really was rather dynamic. His name was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He took over Al-Qaeda in Iraq and started doing some things that Al-Qaeda hadn't done up to that time. And he came along and said, we need to go back and strike terror into the hearts of others. Muhammad did it by beheading, and we're going to do that. He was the first just to really take over and practice beheading his prisoners. In fact, the first American who was ever beheaded was beheaded personally by Zarqawi in Iraq. The other thing he did is said, Al-Qaeda's been fighting the West, but frankly, the Shiites are also disbelievers. They are heretics. We ought to be fighting them. And he began leading the Al-Qaeda, not just to attack Western targets, but to attack the Shiites, who are now taking over control in Iraq. So he began fighting the Shiites and began using some very brutal techniques to try and push himself. Well, we killed him. 2006, I believe it was, he's gone. We kill al-Zarqawi. Yay, it's all done. We're over. Remember, that's when we had our surge going on. We were doing well in Iraq. Things looked to be well under hand. But they weren't quite under hand, because now we come to dot number five, and I wrote ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, all those weird names for the Islamic State. That's what they want you to call it. Our president prefers ISIL. I prefer ISIS, and somebody once asked me, why do I prefer ISIS? And it's because the ISIS crisis works better than the ISIL crisis. Whatever you want to call this group, that's who they are. How did they come about? How did Al-Qaeda in Iraq turn into ISIS? Well, on the screen here, it comes up with a guy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Zarqawi, that last guy, was killed. There were a couple ineffectual leaders who replaced him. It looked like Al-Qaeda was done for in Iraq. And then this guy comes along, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He is a gifted speaker. He actually has his PhD in Islamic thought, where bin Laden was an architect, and Zawahiri was a medical doctor. This guy got his credentials. He cut his teeth on Islamic thought. He knows the Quran. He knows the Hadith. He knows what it says, and he's a gifted orator. And he comes along and takes over in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. For the next slide, here's the 2010 is when he takes over in Iraq. But something else happened that year, something that made his rise possible. The Arab, the U.S. left Iraq. We'll leave it up there. The Arab Spring took place in 2010, and then the following year, the U.S. left Iraq. So right at the time he's rising, there's this turmoil that begins taking place in the Arab country. Starts in Egypt. Went into Libya, went over into Syria. All these areas start going into turmoil, and the U.S. is beginning to pull out of the region at the same time. So we left an area that has all of the makings of a bomb ready to explode. And this guy comes on the scene right at that time. And suddenly, in 2014, you have the fall of Mosul. You see, from 2010 till 2014, Al-Qaeda in Iraq under Abu Bakr was growing. Finally, he came along and said, we need to have some mergers. I'll put it in our terms. He said, Al-Qaeda are actually, well, Syria is having all this turmoil. We're going to merge with the Al-Nusra Front, which was the Al-Qaeda group in Syria. And we're going to merge together, and we're going to have Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq together. The only problem is he didn't bother to call corporate headquarters what he was doing. And Al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, said, you can't do that. The Nusra Front that he was merging with said, this is a hostile takeover. We're not going to join you. And he says, okay, then I'm going to do something else. I'm going to create the Islamic State. Al-Qaeda has been trying to say, we're going to fight. When we get rid of the West, then we'll set up the caliphate. We'll set up the Islamic state the way the Quran wants us to. He says, no, you got it wrong. You first set up the Islamic state, then you drive out all the infidels. We're going to set up the Islamic state. He makes that announcement, and nobody paid much attention. And then in 2014, this group of fighters moved into Mosul, into northern Iraq, and a small group of fighters took out, the estimates are 25,000 Iraqi soldiers, left their weapons, left their armament, and just ran. And suddenly ISIS jumps on the world stage, and people go, who are these people? Where did they come from? Well, they had a long pedigree. And it goes all the way back in 1979 to this rise of Sunni fundamentalism, but ultimately it goes all the way back to Muhammad. And the reason they're having such an influence, such power, and such mobility is that what they're saying resonates with the Quran. They are claiming to be accomplishing what the Quran says that Muslims are to accomplish. They're using techniques that the Quran endorses, that Muhammad himself used. Beheadings. Muhammad beheaded people. There are accounts of him beheading hundreds at a time. The Quran does allow for crucifixion. All the things that you're seeing ISIS doing, the Quran does. ISIS is doing one thing different than everybody else before it. They have harnessed the power of the social media, power of the internet, better than any group before them. Osama bin Laden communicated by sending out messages, secret tapes, very poorly designed videotapes. If you ever saw those tapes, where he's with a background, kind of a sheet draped behind him. ISIS is putting out some of the slickest online magazines that could ever be done. They are using incredible PR. They have the best people putting out some of the slickest publications to promote what they're doing, and it's catching fire with Arabs. Now, we've looked at where the Middle East came from. We've looked at how ISIS rose from the Middle East. I want to do one thing briefly, and then I want to turn off the screen. If you ever watch television, my favorite part sometimes are these weird commercials where they're selling, the dumbest product you'd ever want, the things that will cook potatoes in your microwave for 2 minutes. And they'll always say, though, you can buy this, but wait, there's more. If you order within the next, you get something else. We've just talked about ISIS, and we've brought it all the way up to where we are today. And you go, yeah, man, we know it's a problem. Our country's finally figured out it's a problem. And the answer is, but wait, there's more. There's something that's worse than ISIS. And I just want to go to one more slide, and then we're going to cut it out, because I think it's going to be the next picture that I want up there. Yes. General Joseph Dunford made a statement earlier this year that most people ignored. He said, my assessment is that Russia poses the greatest threat to our national security. And if you look at their behavior, it's nothing short of alarming. And at the time, he was rebuked by our Secretary of State, who went out of his way to say, no, that's not the big issue. It's really ISIS. He's focused on ISIS. And suddenly in the last 2 weeks, what this general was telling us that nobody was paying attention to is starting to happen. And with that, is there a way to just turn to blacken the slides? Because I'm just going to, or I can leave that one up, but either way, I wanted to end with that one, because if you want to know how Russia could be worse than ISIS, you got to come back next week, because Kathy's going to pick up on that subject. I am convinced, and this is how I want to end my section, and then we're going to open it up for questions. I'm convinced that America suffers from a national version of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We're always running around, and we can't keep focused on anything long enough to pay attention. And as a result, we are a visual society led by a secular media. We have a media that doesn't truly understand the currents running through the Middle East. We don't understand the history that brings it about. And that's why we suddenly get panicked and shocked when something new seems to jump on the stage. ISIS shouldn't have surprised us. We should have been seeing ISIS coming for sure since 2010, but we should have been seeing what was happening since 1979, when we saw the birth of twin Islamic fundamentalist terrorist groups, one state-sponsored with the Shiites in Iran, one more terrorist-sponsored with the Sunnis coming first in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, but all of them with the same goal, to establish what the Quran has said. By the way, it's a very triumphant religion. It expects to take over the world. They are evangelistic in that sense, but it's a religion of the sword. Both of those groups are claiming to follow what Muhammad taught. They're being pretty close to what Muhammad taught. And that's why they're finding such impact. The problem is, by the time we finally figured out that they could be a threat, and we so panicked on it, we're now focused on them and missing what's happening in a bigger picture in the Middle East. And my fear is that about the time we all get over ISIS, ISIS is solved, it abates or becomes more manageable, we lose focus, we're going to be surprised again by something else. That's just been the nature of our country. In giving this talk and in writing the book, our main purpose was to help people understand that to understand history is to not be surprised by what's just over the horizon. And the more we understand history, the better prepared we are. And so that's the ISIS crisis and why it's so significant. What I'd like to do now is open it up for questions. I want to make sure we're done by 10:30. We're done by 10:20. So we now have time for any questions. And I see one in the back. They have the... The next event on God's program is to remove the church from the earth, 1 Thessalonians 4. We know believers of those below the age of accountability for believing families would be part of that. What about children who might belong to non-believing families? What happens to them? And the answer is, I'll start this way by saying, the Bible doesn't have a specific verse, chapter and verse where it says, this is what happens to them. So I have to use... not sanctified imagination, but I have to use more principles from the Bible. I think God is a God of justice and fairness, and I do believe there's a point at which where He holds people accountable for their actions. But prior to that, I have three autistic grandchildren. Same family, three autistic grandchildren. One is non-communicative, the other two are more communicative. But I'm watching them. There is a point where they finally start getting... They're accountable for what they're doing. But when they were very young, they didn't. I think God is a God of justice and grace and will do what's right by children who are unable to believe or below an age where they can be accountable for what they're doing. And I think that's true of all children because God's a God of all people. So my best guess, and that's what it is in guess, is that God will extend His grace to those children who can't believe. But I can't point to a specific chapter and verse for that, so you just heard the Charlie Dyer opinion, and you take that one with the whole salt shaker. Yes?
First, I want to thank you for this book. The reason is that I think that it has because I'm Armenian, and I was born in Iran. And I want to thank you for mentioning 1979, because I think Jimmy Carter started sort of all of these things. I wonder what would have happened if America backed up the Shah, kept him there with Ambassador, protecting his men. So these organizations wouldn't have tried in that area. But also, I want to, like you said, connect the dots. Our government is failing. White House, we're putting people in the White House who are, look at the administration for the last 8 years. And what is more, I think, dangerous than ISIS is Muslim Brotherhood, that they're doing it quietly. At least ISIS is doing something that is horrifying for one of us and waking us up. For that, I thank them. You know, Muslim Brotherhood are building one mosque, they're brainwashing our children, they're putting their professors in our schools, in our universities, brainwashing our, you know, our future leaders that they are going to do what they want to do to the president in the White House. And that goes against everything that our government is, because the Muslims' law is their law. They do not think about their law. So yeah. Any president, Muslim president, would just rule this country with the Quran.
Thank you so much for all that information.
Well,
but not sure what your question is.
My question is, what is? I mean, are you going to have the next group? Are you going to say how you're going to? Our church is not waking up. I mean, we are not. You know, we are not waking up. If a storm is coming, you're not going to sit your children and feed them. You're going to tell them to, you know, if you're being attacked. You're not going to say, okay, you're going to asphalt out the streets, you know, we're going to do whatever. You're going to say, wake up. You know, you have to call an arm. So what is the solution? Are you going to have a group, or how are you going to individually or as a church, why should we be politically correct in our churches? Why can't we just bring this up every Sunday?
Let me boil that down to the key elements. And by the way, thank you, because the Armenian genocide by the Turks. If there's a group that understands what Islam can do, there were about 1.5 million Armenians who were put to death in World War I. The Armenians did better under the Shah than when the Iranians came into power with Ayatollah Khomeini. And by the way, I'll add to that, America's policy, this is where I think we really have made a mistake in the Middle East. We've assumed that our goal is to create democracies throughout the world, and if we would just create democracy, the world would be great, everyone would play together well, and we'd all be, you know, couldn't we all just get along? The reality is that the Iranian people voted in the Islamic Republic. In Egypt, they voted in the Muslim Brotherhood. In both cases, once those groups took over, it wasn't that they were creating democracy the way we understand it, which is religious tolerance with a separation of secular and religious. They saw it as we voted in Islam, and now Islam is a religion that controls all aspects of life, and it's not going to be separated from the policies. It's going to be part and parcel of it. I'll back up and just state my opinion. I think we've got to be very careful. Democracy is a wonderful thing. Democracy is a wonderful thing when it's built on Judeo-Christian values that include tolerance, respect, love, and some other aspects. That is not, those aren't part and parcel of democracy. By the way, it was we figured that out in our country, and that's why we had the Bill of Rights added. Democracy with the Bill of Rights is a good thing. That's not what these countries are adopting. Turkey is the one country that tried to make itself a secular country. And if you're following Erdogan, his policies in Turkey today, he's trying to bring it back to become Islamic. He's a very good friend of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is trying to accomplish through the ballot box what ISIS is trying to accomplish on the battlefield. But they both have the same goal. And that's the part I think that gets lost on most Americans. And by the way, I don't blame any one Republican or Democrat. Most of our government is naive when it comes to this, because we're so secular as a nation that we can't imagine that there are religious motives that can motivate people. And that's why we assume that the real problem is the lack of jobs or lack of education. Those aren't the issues. So thank you. Over here, and then I did see one right in the center, then too.
Along with what you're saying, I'm kind of shocked that we're so naive, because these people tell you what their plans are. There's a 10-year plan to, you know, create chaos to welcome back the Mahdi, or, you know, that is the 10-year plan. But I have recently heard that there's a 5-year plan to destroy Rome, and I was wondering if you've heard anything about that. And my other question is, how do we help? How do we help these people being persecuted in the Middle East?
That's in fact two great questions. The first question, you know, is there a plan to destroy Rome, the 5-year plan, and then how can we help the persecuted believers in the Middle East? I can't speak to a five-year plan because I've not heard that. But ISIS made it very clear that their target is Rome. By that they mean Christianity, because they're viewing Rome. And their goal was to flood refugees. It was given in a context of the refugees going from Libya across the Mediterranean. Again, if you watch what's been happening, the one estimate that came out of the Muslim world was that at least 2% of these refugees that have been going into Europe are actually ISIS fighters undercover. Well, if there are 200,000, that's 4,000 terrorists that are trying to slip into Europe right now under cover of refugees. That's a major issue, a major problem. So I don't know if I can say it's a five-year plan, but I do know that their goal is to have Europe become Islamic. They are targeting that, and they're trying to do it generally with the birth rate, but they're not above trying to slip in terrorists to help accomplish their goal. In terms of what we can do for believers, several things. A lot of people would say, shouldn't we be there fighting? Shouldn't we be rescuing the believers out? When I read the New Testament, this will sound counterintuitive. The greatest revival in the Muslim world has taken place in the last 30 years. Their estimates are that there have been about 1 million Iranians who've come to faith in Jesus in the last 30 years because they actually got to see what Islam's ultimate goal looks like, and it's so horrifying that it opened them up to other things. In the book of Acts, what they were asked to pray for, and Paul as well, was to pray for wisdom and for boldness and for protection. And I think that's the first place we start. Prayer isn't the last thing we should do, it's the first thing we should do. We ought to be praying for the believers in the Middle East that God will give them boldness, that God will open the eyes of those around them to the truth of what they have to say, and that God will give them the strength, even if it means giving their life for Jesus, that they'd be willing to do that to serve Him. Now, here's where I'm back up, and I'm going to say something that may offend you. That's okay. I see a difference between what believers should do as individuals and what God appoints nations to do. God gives a standard for Christians. He tells us to turn the other cheek. He tells us to forgive. He tells us to love. God established government to do two things: to hold evil in check and to punish evildoers. That's what the role of government is to be. I'm not, as a Christian, to take vengeance, but God puts the sword in the hand of the authorities, Romans says. I think we ought to push on our government and others to take a stand as a government to try and stop the evil of ISIS. It's better to try and stop it there than when it's here in our own country. So anyway, that's my opinion is that what the government should do as believers, and what we should do for believers is everything to support that, and find a group that's working with Christians in those countries and monetarily help support those groups. I know of several, and that's why I won't give any one. There's a number of them. I suspect this church is working with some. But provide the financial support for them because they are making a difference in the lives of the believers in those countries.
Right.
Sorry, thanks.
Right.
Oh, right over here. Sorry, yes.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your book. It was straight to the point. And my question to you, though, is with Russia's movement in the last years and in recently, what is his goal, or what do you believe his goal is concerning the Ukraine entry?
And again, I wish I could have total access into Putin's mind, but I do think there's enough that's clear. He's restoring Russia's greatness that he feels was lost in the collapse of the Soviet Union. He may not call it the Soviet Union, but his goal is to restore that worldwide influence. He sees the U.S. Withdrawing from the world stage, which provides him the opening. In terms of Ukraine, is a breadbasket, and if the loss of the Ukraine to Russia was a threat, that they would perceive it, to Moscow, to St. Petersburg, it provided an access point. They're trying to regain control of an area that they see as a vital strategic area for them. But I don't think he's going to stop there. And I think he does see a way of interjecting Russia into the Middle East right now, where it's been America's domain for so long. You have to go back to Nixon, by the way. Nixon and Kissinger. When we changed Egypt from being a client of Russia to a client of the U.S. Russia is trying to reverse what they see as almost 50 years of American dominance. And if they can push in that sense, they will. They're just trying to play the different players right now. By the way, the one player that they're still working with, Turkey, Iran and Russia are very close. Russia's selling them some of the most sophisticated systems. Russia's helping them. Turkey and Russia historically have been enemies. but Russia's making a push to try and build a bridge of friendship. They stumbled the last 2 days, by the way, when their jets strayed over Turkey's border with Syria. But apart from that, Russia, long term, Russia has been trying to build even bridges into Turkey to help fracture NATO. So there's a strategic nature there. I wish I knew all of it, but at least those parts seem to be clear. Sorry.
I appreciate the talk and look forward to reading the book. There was an article this summer in the Atlantic, but it's about the rise of ISIS. It talks about meeting the armies of Rome on the plains of the Beak, and it's a really apocalyptic group, and they believe in essentially tearing everything down to get to Armageddon.
Yeah, I can't read that. By the way, I read that article. It is a fascinating article and right on target. That's the part we don't, again, our secular nation. Islam has an eschatology, a doctrine of end times. The Islamic doctrine of the end times, which ISIS holds to, is that there's going to be a cataclysmic battle. It's going to be this town. The West is going to come to that town. Islam is going to look like it's losing, but at the very end, they're going to triumph. Jesus is coming back. He's going to announce to the world that he's a Muslim. They need to turn to him. Seriously, that's their it all fits together. They're watching what's happening now, and they're actually seeing their view of the end times unfolding, and that's energizing them, if nothing else. For a Muslim to die in a holy war is the one way you can be guaranteed to go to paradise, if you die as a martyr. So they don't see a downside in what's happening now. If I die, I'm going to paradise. If I keep surviving and keep going, I'm helping push for the end times when all these events that we've been looking for are about to come to pass. And so that's actually part of the energizing motive behind them, and it's something we don't get as Americans, as secular West. Sorry, anyway.
Thank you so much for taking my question. I was just wondering how this all fits into the War of God in Ezekiel. If you could comment on that.
How does this fit in the War of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38-39? Two quick answers. One is, that's exactly what Kathy's going to talk about next week, so that's why you need to be here next week. And second, it's also a chapter in the book, I do deal with it in there. And by the way, I'll just add that that's why I wanted to end with the Russian. I think Russia is a bigger threat to the West and the Middle East than ISIS has been. ISIS can be stopped. There are ways it can be stopped. Russia is actually showing that brute force is one of those ways right now. But Russia is the bigger threat, and you'll see why next week. Yes.
You're studying the end times. I hear talks about the fact that we should be prepared and not be surprised that the U.S. has to become a weakened world power and weakened economically, and that that's really portrayed in the scripture, and that we shouldn't be surprised by that. But as a believer in today, living in the United States, other than praying for, we pray for the peace of Israel, we pray for all these things that are going on, but again, and this may be something Kathy's getting ready to talk about also, how does all of this play into our lives today as American Christians who live here and watch what's going on if God put our president into place as we believe that he does? Isn't all of this part of what we're studying right now and should be expected? Because there seems to also be this fear and this urgency by Christians that we should try to do something to stop what's happening. And yet, isn't all of this part of God's plan?
That's a great question. Isn't what we're seeing part of God's plan? The end times, so why should we just accept it? And my answer is this. I do think it's part of the end the times. I don't see the United States playing a role in biblical prophecy. The question is, does it mean that the U.S. stays strong until God removes his church from the country, at which point it collapses? Or could our country be what Britain was 100 years ago when it was the dominant power, and our country just collapses morally, economically, long before the end times roll out. And that is possible. But how do we respond? And my answer is Micah chapter 3. Micah the prophet gives this incredibly dark, he paints a dark portrait. He talks about a time of... I always find this better when I actually read it rather than trying to summarize it for you. Micah chapter 3. He starts and he says, listen, you rulers of Jacob, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of the house of Israel. Should you not know justice, you who hate good, love evil, tear the skin off my people, the flesh from their bodies. He basically says, hey, civil leaders, you're absolutely corrupt. You're supposed to do justice. That's the job of the government, to be just. And they were perverting it. And then he turns to religious leaders. He comes to the prophets in verse 5. This is what the Lord says. As for the prophets who lead my people astray, if one feeds them, they proclaim peace. If they don't, they prepare to wage war against them. So you go to a prophet and you say, what does God want me to do? And the prophet would say, what's it worth to you to know? Feed me, give me something, and I'll make sure God does good things for you. You don't give me what I want, though, and God's going to judge you. You know, they said, you want to know God's hand? I've got the access. It's going to cost you to get it. They were ripping people off. He comes down to the priests at the time. You know, the ones who were to teach God's word. And I'll jump down, again, I'm skipping a lot of verses, but jump down to 11. Her leaders judge for a bribe. Her priests teach for a price. Her prophets tell fortunes for money. The priest, she went to the priest and said, what's God's word say? Because she didn't have a copy of the Bible. And the priest said, pay me and I'll tell you. You don't give me the money though, and you go out and do what you want. Boy, you violate God's law, he's going to get you. I used to teach at Dallas Seminaries. When I would teach this section, I'd say to them, you went to them and said, what's God's word say? And he said, well, it's going to cost you $175 a semester hour to find out. The whole nation was corrupt. In fact, he ends up saying it's so bad, they're going to hell in a handbasket. He says, verse 12, therefore, because of you, Zion will be plowed like a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, the temple hill, a mound overgrown with thickets. This nation is going to be wiped out because of your evil. And you go, man, that's terrible. But I skipped something in the midst of it. If you read the whole thing, right in the middle of this whole section, Micah says, that's where it's all going. But verse 8, but as for me, I'm filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgressions, to Israel his sin. He says, that's where the nation's going. You need to know something. I'm going a different direction. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to say what's right. I'm going to live what's right. The chapter ends, and you think, yeah, great. You just were spitting into the wind, Micah. I mean, you're going to do what's right, but this whole nation's going down. What difference could one person make in a nation that's heading the wrong direction? And the answer happens to be found in Jeremiah chapter 26. Jeremiah is tried for treason. He's arrested. He's going to be tried. He's going to be put to death. They take him for a quick trial. And in the middle of it all, verse 17, some of the elders of the land stepped forward and said to the entire assembly of the people, Micah of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. He told all the people of Judah, this is what the Lord says. And they quote Micah chapter 3. They quote the last verse. And then they give the answer that Micah didn't tell us. Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, or anyone in Judah put him to death? No. Didn't Hezekiah fear the Lord, seek his favor, and did not the Lord relent? So he did not bring the disaster he pronounced against them. Micah stood up and said, I don't care where everybody else is going. I'm doing this. And someone listened to what he had to say. It happened to be the king. The king said, you know, he's right. We ought to be doing that. And Micah's willingness to stand up saved the nation of Judah for 100 years. So our country's on the wrong trajectory. So what should we do? We need to stand up and do what's right. We need to be salt and light. And it's up to God whether people are going to listen and respond or not. That's not our responsibility, that's His. But we can stand up and do what's right. And Micah did that, and he saved the nation. And I like to use that as a good example. One person with the Spirit of God behind them can do an awful lot. So that's more the positive side than the negative to it. But I tend to be the optimist on that. Sorry, yes.
Just a question. You had referenced earlier in your lecture this population explosion, 100 to 150%. And then you made a comment later that saying in Europe, even though they're slagging in possible terrorists, that they're those huge jumps happen, and how are they teaching that? Is that a part of Muslim faith to, say, go out and now teach children, or how is that being introduced into their strategy?
Yeah, I don't recall a verse in the Quran that tells them to have the children, but in actual practice, a Muslim family can in some countries you can have up to four wives. I say multiple wives, and the average woman is having the six, seven, eight children. My daughter and her husband lived in Jordan for a while. They actually were trying to learn Arabic to do witnesses there. They chose not to have children, and the number one question that they were always getting is, why don't you have any kids? Because it's expected to have large families. And so the population of Europe, much like here in the U.S., the Western population is not even at a sustainable level in terms of children. The Muslims are far exceeding that, and their expectation is we'll grow the majority. So if we can't take it over by one way, we'll take it over by another. But that is very deliberate on their part.
Thank you very much. I'll read your book. It sounds like it would be really helpful. But my question is, as citizens of the United States of America and Christians, what should we do to tell our senators and House of Representatives about bringing them to this country?
I don't have a good answer for you. And I'll say it this way, because our country historically has opened its arms to people. My family came from Germany and England, as a trace back to heritage. What I would say is, if we want to open our arms, let's make sure that we're letting in those that aren't going to be trying to undercut our nation. An example would be letting in Armenians, Yazidis, the persecuted minorities within these countries. I would prefer to let in those who truly are the ones being persecuted, because they're the ones who are going to be more likely to accept and adopt and commit. That's not necessarily the group that we're seeing going into Europe right now. Some are, but again, I got to be careful not to overgeneralize. But if we're going to let people into our country, why don't we try and target the ones who truly are more akin to American culture and more accepting? That'd be, if they asked me, that's what I would tell them. And that's my, words up here, the words of the person, don't necessarily represent the management or the station that sponsors this.
Going back to your beginning of this conversation, you mentioned that there are some Christians who are the descendants of Muhammad, the Sunnis, or the Shia?
Which ones were the what of
Muhammad? Blood descendants.
Oh, the descendants of Muhammad. Oh, yeah. So which ones were the ones who wanted the physical descendants of Muhammad? They were the Shiites. The Shiites wanted Ali, who was a physical relation, not descendant, a physical relative of Muhammad's, to be it. The Sunnis wanted another Abu Bakr. The guy who's the head of ISIS now, the first Sunni was named Abu Bakr as well. They wanted him. He was the most capable follower of Muhammad, and they thought he was the one who was worthy, even though he was a relative but not a blood relative. So the Sunnis want their tradition is to have the most capable, what does the group decide? The Shiites were the ones who wanted to have a blood relative follow along. Yes, over here.
I have a question. What about the Muslims that are living here in the States now? What role do they play? A lot of them are very peace-loving people. Will they play a part in
it? Good question. What role do the Muslims play here in the States? Again, well, I'm a very peace-loving people, and they are. And what I would end up saying is, this is somewhere, I distinguish between Muslims and Islam. And I do it this way. The majority of Americans call themselves Christians. For those who truly know the Bible, believe the Bible, follow the Bible, you would say, well, a lot of people who call themselves Christians, they aren't Christians as they're described in the Bible. They're more traditional, more cultural, the family connection to Christianity. There are Muslims who are very peace-loving, very, very loving, who don't really know the Quran. They have not read the Quran. They're Muslim because their parents were Muslim. They're Muslim because of tradition. But Islam itself, if they believe that the Quran is the word of God, they believe that the Quran teaches us without error, Islam is a very evangelistic, in that sense, religion. Islam cannot be, I guess that's the right way, Carson got in trouble for saying what was actually true. Someone who would truly follow Islam cannot be someone who would accept the laws of the United States, because the laws of the United States would be subject to Sharia law. And that's what Islam would teach. Now, not all Muslims believe, not all Muslims know what Islam teaches. And so a lot of them, most Muslims are wonderful. I have a quote, and I took it out of this presentation, but Winston Churchill in 1899 made a quote about Muslims being wonderful people, but Islam being a very dangerous religion. And he would be arrested in England for saying what he said. But what he said is as true today as it was in 1899 when he first said it. Most Americans don't believe that and struggle with it. Let's see. Any other questions? Because we're just about out of time.
Back to the very beginning, the basics of Genesis. Tell us how Abram's two sons affect all of this.
Yeah, Abram had Isaac and Ishmael. And Hagar the Egyptian, that's where I'm trying to get to. If Abraham hadn't disbelieved God and gone to Egypt, we probably wouldn't have some of the problems we have today. But when he went to Egypt, he was given a handmaid. Sarah was given a handmaid named Hagar. The culture that day said if you can't have a child, the way you have it is have one of your servants be the surrogate mother. Hagar became that surrogate mother that Sarah gave to Abraham. She had Ishmael. Eventually, he was cast out of the Hagar and Ishmael were cast out of the family. It's interesting, by the way. Some take the Ishmael being cursed. Actually, if I read the accounts, Ishmael had 12 sons, and they were given a blessing by God. The blessing didn't include the land that God had promised to Abraham and his descendants. But that's where some of the problem comes. They both claim Abraham. The real issue is, but which one was the son of promise? And both the Old Testament and New Testament say it was through Isaac that the son of promise was called. By the way, not all Arabs came from Ishmael. The other, I moved down, Jacob and Esau. Esau was the other son who lost the promise. He ended up becoming the Ammonites, and the Edomites. And they also are lumped into the Arabs today. So Arabs today come from a lot of different groups. The Egyptians were descendants of Ham initially, not descendants of Shem or connected to Abraham. But it gets. I watch your eyes. That's when you go. So I'll stop there. It gets really complex. But basically, Ishmael had blessings. They don't include the promised land that God gave to Isaac. And that's really some of the start of the problem between the Arabs and the Jews. Yes?
Aren't there some in the valley, I'm thinking of one person, that is out to restore or reform Islam? You made that distinction between...
There are. Actually, there are several. It's interesting. A lot of them tend to be here in the United States. They're trying to say... almost undefensible position, because they're saying, well, yes, that's what Islam taught, but maybe it was for that cultural time that we can't take those things that the Quran says and apply them to today. The problem with that is that that's not accepted by the vast majority of Muslims, because the fundamental tenet of Islam is that the Quran is the word of God, and they have a principle called abrogation. So some of the earlier things Muhammad said were abrogated, replaced by some of the later things he said, and it's the later parts of the Quran that are really the more warlike parts of the Quran. So there are groups who are trying to say that. They're not getting a lot of traction anywhere else within the Muslim world, because it's so contrary to the fundamental tenets of Islam.
But how should we observe them and understand them?
I think it depends on our the question, how should we understand them and approach them? I think we would say, yes, but I understand what you're saying, and yet you're saying you have some of the problems with some of these statements in Islam that I have a problem with. But how does that rest with? Do you believe that the Quran isn't the inspired, inerrant message from Allah? And if they're willing to say yes to that, at that point there's a good chance for a dialogue. But it'd be hard for most Muslims to be able to say that.
We need to be careful, though.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Thank you.